My name is Natalia, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have a list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Adriana will read the preamble.
Hi, my name's Adriana, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Stephen will read the steps.
Hi, my name's Stephen. I'm an alcoholic. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number ten, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Carol will read the traditions.
I am Kara, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself, and our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Dave.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
Wow. It's really great to be here. I see a lot of familiar faces, and I see a lot of new faces, too, and that's great because, as we all know, you know, the way we stay sober now is by helping newcomers, and if there were no newcomers, we wouldn't be able to stay sober. So it's great to see so many new faces in this room, and I haven't been coming to this group for about a year because I moved up to Connecticut, and I joined a group up in Mamaroneck called the Harbor Island Group, and this group is even bigger than when I left about a year ago, and it's amazing. My story is not that tremendous. Can you hear me okay? Is that better? I'm 46 years old, and I think my total drinking slash using career was probably 6 or 7 years of my life. And I have coming up on 4 years of sobriety, so there's a long period of time in my life where I wasn't drinking, but I also wasn't going to AA. And I think the reason my drinking career is so short is because I think I was an alcoholic before I ever picked up a drink. And as soon as I did, I took it right to the hilt. I mean, I went crazy right away. I was about 14 years old when I picked up the first drink. And that first time was, it lifted all of the fears I had as a young child. That's about the only memory I have of my childhood. Was I was always afraid. I always felt like I didn't fit in. I always felt, you know, wrong, and a lot of self-centered fear. And that first time I actually got a buzz off of alcohol, all that was sort of lifted away. And then the second time I picked up a drink, I went right into a blackout. And it was I was pretty much a blackout drinker from then on. Whenever I was around alcohol and I was not constrained in the amount I could drink, I drank until I was blacked out and passed out, just period. That's just how I always drank. It was never any different than that. I had all the same things we all talk about. There's plenty of times I went out planning not to drink, and woke up somewhere the next morning not knowing how I got there. Mayhem. So that lasted through my high school career and into the first year of college. And by then I had already had enough. And I came into AA for the first time then at the age of 19. And I did what they told me to do. I joined a group. I got a sponsor. I did 90 meetings in 90 days. I went through the steps, and I did believe, you know, that AA could help me. And in fact, it did. The first time I came into AA, and I was able to get my life back together. The thing that had gotten me into AA the first time was failing out of college, and I was able to put myself back in college. I got a scholarship to go on to a four-year school, and I graduated. And, you know, all of that was due to the fact that I wasn't drinking anymore and I was going to AA meetings. The only problem was that at some point when I got back into college, I started thinking that I had done it, that I had gotten myself back to this place. And I stopped seeing the necessity of AA in my life gradually, and it was very gradual. I tapered off on meetings very gradually until I was down to one meeting a week, down to one meeting a month, until I wasn't going to meetings at all anymore. And that was after being, you know, an active member in AA for probably 5 or 6 years. I had gone through the steps. I had sponsored people. I had gone out speaking on outgoings. I had done a lot of service, but you know, I guess I just never understood that I was powerless over alcohol and that God had saved me from my disease, or had shown me a path I could walk down to stay sober. And I forgot that. And it's funny though, because I actually white knuckled it for probably 10 or 15 years after that, maybe a little bit more. I got married. I had a son, and I had a good job, and I made money, and I had a house, and I had a car, and I, you know, all that good stuff. I got all that stuff, but I didn't have God in my life anymore. And I started thinking about, you know, all the good times I had missed by coming in, because when I was only 19. And so to make a long story short, what wound up happening was I divorced my wife and started drinking. And I didn't start drinking because I got divorced. I divorced my wife so I could go out and do what I wanted to do. And that's just the truth. That's what it was. I wanted to be alone. I wanted to be on my own. And I wanted to capture that youth that I had missed. And so I started. And I'll say at this point in my story that I didn't drink alcohol. The last drink I had was in 1983. But I picked up some other things. But it doesn't matter. I'm an alcoholic, and it was my alcoholism that was affecting me and driving me at that point. And I was a full-blown alcoholic. And it only took me about a year and a half to lose everything that I had, everything. And I don't even mean just the stuff. You know, my relationship with my son was damaged. All of the relationships with every member of my family was shot. I had lost it all. I was completely alone. And, you know, I had been living a dual life. You know, I picked up again and I started, you know, going out and partying again and trying to keep this from all the people that were close to me, which was almost impossible. They found out, and that's sort of when the jig was up. And it didn't take very long. I think the thing that got me to walk back in the rooms was when my son's mother found out what I was doing. She, you know, wouldn't let me see him anymore. And that's when I knew that I had been, you know, brought to my knees once again. And it was something very important in my life had been taken away from me. And I had seemingly had no control over it. And I came back in here into this room, to this meeting. And I sat right back there, and this became my home group. And, you know, I met a lot of really great people in this group, and I got a sponsor, and I went to a meeting every day for the first 90 days again. And that was, you know, after, you know, claiming to be sober for, you know, 20 years, having to come back in and start my 90 days over again was really, really difficult. But the fact of the matter was I really didn't have anywhere else to go, and I sort of knew that. I mean, that was one of the gifts I had gotten from coming around once before, was I knew when I walked in the rooms, this is where I needed to be. And, you know, today, life is great. I mean, but it's just okay, and that's great. I have the relationships back with my son. I'm able to be a father. I'm able to be a son to my parents. I'm able to be a brother, and I'm able to help people in Alcoholics Anonymous, newcomers. I'm able to sponsor people today and help them. And you know, I got a decent job back and I got some of that stuff back. But what's really important to me now is just the ability to be there for the people that are important to me in my life. And I never realized that that was an important thing until I got it back, until I lost it and got it back. And, you know, the steps teach us how to deal with life on life's terms. And just being able to do that today, one day at a time, is such a gift to me. And I owe it, you know, really to the people that were here when I came here and opened up their hearts and put out their hands and offered to help me, despite how ashamed I was of myself and how horrible I felt about myself. You know, these people showed me the way back. You know, they showed me the path. They continue to do so. I have great friends in AA now that I can call anytime I have a problem, anytime something's bothering me or something's just not right. I can call them up and just talk and tell them what's going on, and they understand and they help. And I can't really say enough, you know, about what a turnaround AA has brought about in my life and by following the simple principles in this program. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I'd like to thank Eddie for asking me to speak. He was my first sponsor in this group. And I'd like to thank you all for being here. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Sloan. Hi, I'm Sloan, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 5th of 2008. My sponsor is Joan Morgan. She sits over there. And this is my home group, and I really, really love it. And I moved here a little over a year ago, and I just want to say thank you collectively to the group because you guys have helped me with my life since I moved here. I don't know how I would do it without you. So I took my first drink where I got tipsy when I was 12 years old. I was sitting in my bed. I remember what my room looked like. And I was watching Boy Meets World on the Disney Channel. You guys know this? And I was having a Heineken, and it was just amazing. Corey and Topanga really flourished that night. And I remember, I didn't really know what alcohol did to me before then. I'm from Texas, so we have a lot of barbecues and there's a lot of beer sort of hanging out when I was little. And I would take sips every once in a while and be like, Mom, can I have some of this? And she's like, yeah, have some. So I would take a sip and I'd be like, it doesn't taste as good as Sprite. So, but when I got older and I started to see the commercials on TV, it's like, have a Bud Light, and it was like all these people just sort of moving around. I didn't really know what that meant, but I was going to find out. So I did anyway. So Boy Meets World, I'm having this Heineken. I get up to pick out my clothes for the next day for school, and I'm just like, wow, okay, this is the Bud Light commercial. So I had another one, and that was my first night of drinking, and I would have had more, but I kept having to go to the bathroom. Like, I was, like, getting up and down, and I fell asleep. So that was my first experience. I don't know really what my next experience was. It was probably blacking out. Lots of nights waking up in the middle of a blackout and just being like, what's going on right now? I don't know where I am, and that's scary. And it started to not get fun anymore, really, really quickly for me. I'm going to tell you real quick, my first sort of impression of Alcoholics Anonymous was from my father, who got sober when I was 10 years old. And I had seen him drink, and I had seen it kind of ruin our family. And my parents were divorced, but I would go visit my dad on the weekends, and he would always go pick up a 12-pack. And I was like, I wonder why he needs so many. And so I found it. I mean, now I know. But
you know, he would always say, I'm going to a meeting. I'm like, what are these meetings that you go to, you know? And he's like, well, you know, I'm trying to clean up a little bit with my life. So I would call them white tooth meetings. I'm like, oh, he's going to the white tooth meetings. You're trying to clean up, you know? So that was sort of what I first thought of AA, and that was around 10, 11 years old when my dad was consecutively going to meetings. He'll be celebrating 9 years next month, so that's awesome. I got to some really low places in my drinking. The first time I tried to stop was when I was 15. I went to Disney World. I had been drinking a lot every day, and I decided that this would be a great time to see if I could stop, because I had a friend call me, and she said, Sloan, maybe your life wouldn't be so bad, and you wouldn't cry all the time and not have any friends if you stopped drinking. I'm like, what makes you think that? You know, and I was like, but I could stop drinking if I wanted to. And she's like, so, you know, go for it. And I was like, but I don't need to right now. You know, I don't need to. My life isn't bad enough. And it was, my life was terrible. And I had never really failed school before, and I had never really had anything bad happen with my parents to where they didn't want me to live with them before. That was kind of new for me, and only because of drinking, and I couldn't really see that. And when I tried to stay sober when I went to Disney World, it was very eye-opening. I remember being very angry in the happiest place on earth, and So I remember someone stepped on my shoe, and I was just angry for the rest of the day. I was like, why did they step on my shoe? So, you know, I now understand that as my alcoholism. You know, that's what happens when I don't take care of myself. So my first experience with AA, I went into a meeting, and all I remember is I heard a woman speak, and she talked about how she was a mom and she wanted to be the cool mom and drink with the kids. And I was like, that could be me in 20 years. So I got it, like, that day. So I tried to get sober when I was 15. I went to rehab. I really didn't want to listen to what you had to say. I actually dropped out of my outpatient because they told me I couldn't have a boyfriend. And I was like, bye. But I did stay sober for a year and a half. And what happened during that year and a half is that I knew Alcoholics Anonymous could keep me sober. Did I do what it takes? No, I didn't do what it takes to stay sober in that year and a half. And I stopped going to meetings, like he said. Started to be once a week, then once a month, then never. And life really started to happen for me. My mother was killed when I was 16 years old, and while I was sober, I was 16, she was killed by a man who was blacked out drunk. And I was sober, and I hadn't been showing up at AA, and I didn't have this program. I knew this was the solution, but I wasn't working it, and I consistently stopped working the program and didn't come to meetings, and I got drunk again when I was 17 years old. I drank for 3 months, and I lost everything that I had gained in that year and a half. I lost the trust of my father, I lost the trust of all my friends, and I dropped out of high school because I drank for those 3 months. That's how much that's how much I lost. And those 3 months later, I came back to AA because I knew that this is where it was. I knew the first meeting, like, that this is where it was. And I was 17 years old, and I came into a meeting, and I found a woman who had what I thought was some pretty good sobriety. She took me through the steps. I remember in my first 9 months of sobriety, I mean, I wanted to drink every day. I wanted to. So if you're in here right now and you want to drink and you have, you know, if you want to drink at all, it doesn't mean that you have to, and it doesn't mean that you have to not say anything about it. Because I wanted, and I called people, and I said, I want to drink, and I have, you know, most people that have like 9 months of sobriety, do they want to drink? And I talked to a woman on the phone, and she said, you know what, I wanted to drink for a really long time, but all I know is that AA works for me, and I just have to show up. And so I started showing up. I started doing whatever it took to stay sober because I didn't want to not have any friends anymore. I didn't want to lose myself again. I thought I was a pretty cool person, but I couldn't, like, get it together when I was drunk. You know what I mean? It's like nothing worked out. I failed school. I wasn't able to go back to high school. So I got sober. I went to college when I was 17, a year early. I took my GED and got into college. Only a gift of the program. I wouldn't have done that if I wasn't sober. I would have ran away. And I moved up here to New York about a year ago. And I have been staying sober. I got Jonah. I called Peggy on my way up here. Someone had given me her number because I was getting connected in AA. So I called her on there. I'm like, I don't know who you are, but my sponsor gave you my number, and I need a sponsor. Can you give me someone's number? Can you be my sponsor? I don't know what to do. I'm driving, and I was like driving here with all my stuff in the car. It was a little ridiculous, but that's how bad I wanted to stay sober. And so she hooked me up with Joan, and Joan has been my sponsor since then. And I still call her every day because that's what I need. I need this structure. I need the structure of this group. And if you're new, I have 1 minute. So if you're new and you feel like you're not connected and you're not really getting into this whole AA thing, it's probably because you aren't. So I just wanted to say that they're going to talk about the piano in a minute and like where you can go get involved, and there's a lot of like flyers and there's a lot of people who do service. Watch the people who hang up the stuff and the dude who moves the microphone. Those are the people who are involved in the group, and those are the people that do service, and like those are the people that you want to go up and shake their hand after the meeting, because that is who's rocking AA out. And like, this is what works for me today, and I really, really, really hope that it can work for you too, because I can tell you that when I was 15 years old and I was messing with guns and there were people, I was messing with a lot of bad people, y'all. I don't even know. I was like, oh my God, this person has a gun. And I never thought that I'd be standing up here like in a little jacket and stuff today. So I hope that, I hope that helped you. Okay, bye.
Tonight, our main speaker is Eddie.
It's very comforting to be greeted by my friend Therese there. I liked the neutral colored jumper she had on, and she was standing so straight. I half expected her to start showing where the exits are and how to inflate the life jacket, you know. That was really nice. And look around here, I'd like to thank my friend Jeff for asking me to speak. I look around this venue, and being in a venue like this, I feel like I ought to be saying the 23rd Psalm or something like that at a relative's funeral. Or I remember when I walked in here just a little while ago, a time where I had to sing the Ave Maria. And I do sing, but I'm going to spare you that. Usually we get Judy C to come in here and do things like that. So I will just tell you why I'm here. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Eddie. I have a home group. It's the New But West group on the West Side. We have two meetings every weekday at noon and at 5:30, noon, 12:30 and 5:30. We have two meetings on the weekends. I have a sponsor. His name is Jim. I prayed today. I could stay away from the first drink, and I do service. I've been around for a while. I feel very fortunate about that. I got sober fairly early in my life. I didn't get sober the first time, but I got sober fairly early. In fact, not to boast or anything, but this is just part of my story. I'm really thrilled that, I'm not around long enough, like some people that I've met in AA. I didn't meet Bill W., and I certainly didn't meet Bob, but I met Lois, you know, at my first Bill W. dinner dance. She gave, that was her last, and it was my first, and she gave Bill's farewell address, or Bill's last message to us. I come from uptown. That's where my story starts. Born in the Bronx. I've lived most of my life last stop on the A train. And I don't know where to draw any kind of line as far as where I crossed over into alcoholism. My earliest remembrances of drinking alcohol, I was already concerned with, I had an obsession. I was worried about where the supply was. If I could be the kid that was going out to the fire escape and bringing in more bottles of sparkling burgundy, we had very, high taste there, cold duck, whatever we were drinking on, holidays, or if I could be the kid going to the, with the blender and the daiquiris. I wanted to be in charge of the supply. That's the position I wanted to be in. And I also was aware of, I was trying to control my drinking. I wanted to get that nice feeling, but I didn't want to get flagged. I didn't want to, have them next holiday tell me I couldn't have any. So I was trying to make a balance with drinking alcohol from a very early age there. I was allowed to drink in my family. I was also allowed to drink. My family did a very courageous thing now that I think of it. My parents had three sons. I was the eldest at 9. We're kind of Irish triplets. We come right, three in a row. And they took us to Europe in 1972. And I was being the oldest and being 9, I was allowed to drink. They came up in the 60s. They were kind of folkies. They're both professors, so they're, kind of lefty liberal. Since we were in Europe and little kids can have a little bit to drink, they did. But I remember by the time we were in a VW van driving around, and I remember our first stop, we drove through France. We first stop in Spain, there was an amusement park where if you go to the shooting gallery there, you could shoot and win bottles of wine. And we were there for like 3 days. I won a lot of bottles of wine. Most of them were miniature, but some days I was a good shot and I got like magnums or big bottles of wine. So we threw them in the VW camper and continued to drive. And on our way through Spain, when we would have lunch or picnics alongside the road, I'd pick out a little bottle of wine for me to drink. And the miniature one seemed like nobody, minded. But they started to think about my drinking when I pulled out the big boys. And I got mad about it. I was like, you told me I could drink, and this is 9 years old. My drinking continued like sanctioned drinking around my family or at parties. I was in show business very early, semi-professionally. I worked in some dinner theaters and stuff, and I worked in some summer stock and whatever. But I got to drink at like theater parties and stuff like that. It's also part of my story that I went on stage for the first time at age 10. I went on stage drunk for the first time at age 11. And so I drank there. This was all the sanctioned drinking. By age about 13 or so, after I graduated from high school, up in my neighborhood, the official drinking age is really when you're 8th grade graduation. Come from a heavily Irish neighborhood. And really, 8th grade graduation is the line where anything goes, pretty much. You can already, that's the age you can buy beer in bodegas. You had to be 15 or 16 as a guy to drink in the bars, a little bit younger for women. And seriously, and you could stay there till dawn. It would only be 16-year-olds and off-duty cops in the bars up in my neighborhood at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning. But I started drinking unsanctioned, like out on the street or in the woods up there where I was. And that was a big step for me because I could get in trouble now. That I wasn't approved of by my family. And also I was scared. I didn't know if I could really, really, hang with these guys. Up in my neighborhood, the worst thing you could possibly be called is called a spiller. And a spiller is the kind of person that if you all get a six pack and you go up to the woods and you start drinking the six pack, most people will drink their beer and throw it over the wall and you hear like a ping kind of sound. The spiller is the kid who takes a couple of sips, throws it over the wall and you hear a clunk, right? And, that was really anathema. You couldn't be that in my neighborhood. And I found out fairly quickly that I wasn't a spiller. I could, drink as much as anybody, and I could, in fact, drink a little bit more. And that's where my story really starts to take over, my love affair with alcohol. Because as a young person, I had, dreams and aspirations and things that I maybe wanted to be when I grew up. And it was all very scary. And they also all involved, like, work, practice, some kind of continuum that you work on with no guarantees and everything, like very, very frightening for me as a young person. When I started to drink on a regular basis, all of a sudden I found out that I got exactly what I wanted. And all I wanted was a persona. You know, I wanted to be known as something. I wanted to be accepted as something. I wanted people to know me as something. And I got to be known as a guy who could drink, a young person, young man who could drink. And it was kind of good enough for me. It was so easy. I didn't have to practice. I didn't have to study. I just had to unflip the cap. So I really found heaven in a sort of way there. And I enjoyed everything about it. I enjoyed the rituals. You know, we didn't all have gloves at the same time. So we would share gloves to, you know, drink in snowbanks up in my neighborhood in the winter. And, you know, pass around things in a circle. And then you get to drink in bars and, you know, people knock on the bar. You know, there's all this symbolism and stuff like that. You put a little money here. They take a little money. They put some back, you know. All these ordeals and everything was very, very comforting. It really made me feel belong. And so I ran with that for a long time. It even went so far as I began to drink more and more into high school and stuff, I really was looking, that became a very, such an important part of my persona, that's all I was looking for. In fact, I kind of left expectations, or I thought drinking was going to get me to some other expectations. I was going to land somewhere and become, I just wanted notoriety. I wanted a persona and I wanted notoriety. And alcohol was getting me there. And whether it was people saying, I want to hang out with you or stay away from that kid, didn't matter much to me. They noticed me. And, you know, as alcohol began to take more and more possession of me, I kind of started to like that because it was taking me, you know, in a kind of sick fantasy way. I thought I was becoming somebody because maybe I'll die from alcoholism now, like a great rock star has, or some famous writer or something. And at that point in my life, very young, I really started living my life for my biographers and not for me. You know, I lived my life as, you know, if somebody was writing it, running behind me, taking notes, and, you know, Eddie started out tonight in the Bronx, and then, you know, in the morning he was in Atlantic City, or he's being dragged up the stairs in Penn Station, Philadelphia, by two policemen. And these things happened, and, so my own welfare or feeling good about myself or anything really went to the wayside, you know. And so if I was in places with guns or if, you know, all these dangerous things happening, it was just a better story. And I think that's what I was shooting for. First time I ever stopped drinking for somebody was my girlfriend in high school. And I was recalling as I walked over here that, you know, once we stayed in her aunt's place on Park Avenue, right over here, 61st and Park, I think. And so I know a little bit about Park Avenue. I know a lot about park benches. In fact, it reminds me that at one point I would wake up on park benches. We have a big park up where I live up north. And, one time I didn't even make it to the park bench. My friends actually stuck me like a V, my behind down into a garbage can. So I was stuck like a V with my behind down and my feet and my head up in a garbage can. And a lady from my neighborhood arose me the next day by kicking over the garbage can. And I like to remember that kind of thing, you know, because at that moment in my life, I was a human piece of trash, you know, in a very literal way. And, you know, the funny thing was, is I hung on to that as something like a, you know, it was almost like a dog tag. Like, yeah, I've been here, I did that, and, you know, somebody pulled a gun on me and this and that. You know, those were my dog tags. That's where I got my esteem from. You know, to speed it up, I was in dangerous situations. And I also had a habit when things got very serious in my drinking, of falling down for a while. Eventually in my drinking, my tolerance was neither here nor there. It kind of changed. I didn't know what amount of alcohol, when at one time, you know, I could drink vast amounts of alcohol. I didn't know how much would put me into a blackout. I began to hear things like, Eddie, you're okay until, you know, and then I would have to get the rest of the story. I had a personality change, and I'd have to hear it from other people because I was in blackouts. I fell down. I had accidents. I wasn't yet of the age to drive, but I used to get to go down the shore in the summer times, and I had bad bicycle accidents where I bust up my face and lose teeth and different stuff like that. And, you know, I started to always, you know, at this period of my life, I was thinking of them as isolated events, like, oh, that was a bad accident, I better take it easy, you know. And all, and actually, the people I was hanging out, we all wrecked bikes. We all had road rash from stuff like that, because that's the people, you know, who I hung out with. I didn't hang out with people who didn't drink like me. You know, it was a society. I felt like I was in a society, and that's what I gravitated towards. As soon as I was old enough to drink in bars, I liked to go to CD bars. I drank across the street from Times School, from the Port Authority, in a place called the Terminal Bar. Sometimes I liked to go to 42nd Street back in those days. You know, I was born in the Bronx. I went to high school in the Bronx, so a lot of my drinking story takes place in the Bronx in those years. As well as nice places down in the Jersey Shore and stuff. But like I was saying, the events in my life that were painful or dangerous or bad or that I got in trouble for, I just tried to regard as isolated incidents. Because if there were anything like a pattern, then I might have to be prompted to do something or look at it. And I wasn't prepared to do that because alcohol was what was holding me together, basically. You know, never took any fear away from me, or never filled anything in that hole in my stomach that I was experiencing. It did keep me going, though, and at a fairly young age. It certainly, by the time I got to high school, by the time I got to college, I was doing maintenance drinking. I think you talked about 12 packs. I had to have 12 packs. The first thing I did, I was 17 when I got to college, and the first thing I did was got a refrigerator for my, you know, one of those little things, and. You know, and I would get, I needed 12 packs just to, you know, keep maintenance. I think there was a period of my life, and please, I'm not saying this to make my story any more grandiose than anybody's. It doesn't matter what alcohol, how much we drank in here. I mean, there are no big shots in AA, small shots, and no story is better than the other. Big shots, small shots, one shot. We're all shot, I've been told. You know. I also have I don't want to forget to say this. I also am very, was really calmed when I was coming around here early on, and somebody said to me that the world record for sobriety was 24 hours, and all I had to do was work on tying it for that day. And, you know, so I've always, you know, hold on to that. There's something about having time in AA that's quite, you know, golden, but I really adhere to the, you know, that saying that the world record for sobriety is 24 hours. I'm working on that today. So when I did get to college, I got the refrigerator. And I think there were periods of time where I don't know if I drank any beverage, you know, any amount of water or any amount of anything. If I was really, really hungover, I would get Diet 7-Up or something like that. But beer was my maintenance drink. And I remember needing alcohol at that time. You know, to stop shaking and sweating, basically. I was 17 in college. I would get up in the middle of the night. I didn't ever know where I could buy booze. I was in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And, but I'd just get up at 1 o'clock in the morning. The bars closed at 2, and I'd go into the town and try to find a place that would, you know, I guess the drinking age is 21 in New Jersey, but I found places, you know, thankfully, because it was getting panicky time for me. I used to have to try to make sure that I had enough to hold me for a while and stuff like that. And then again, like I was drinking at the Terminal Bar, I found a place. I'm going to Rutgers University, right? And where I hang out is not in any of the college bars. I hung out in the Penn Bar by the railroad tracks, you know. And, you know, conductors, like people with those, like, striped blue and white hats, like conductors were hanging out there. You know, old railroad men. That's where I drank. I got a job in town at the hippest, coolest restaurant. They had an ad for a creative dishwasher. So I said, that's me. And I went down there. I interviewed, and I guess we smoked a little pot or something, me and the owner, and I got hired as the creative dishwasher. And so that was, it was a great drinking job. And yeah, I just remember, you know, the only other things I'll say about my college there is I remember I failed out, I got kicked out of Rutgers twice. And I remember going into work. I worked Fridays and Saturdays, and I had to be at work at 4 on Fridays. And I remember days that it was almost I would wake up panicky, sweaty at 3:30, and, you know, just have to wash up and get there until I could, you know, drink a few. We had huge mugs of beer, just drink a few mugs of beer to be able to function and not cut myself, you know, when I was cooking. You know, I graduated to being a creative cook after a little while. I actually spent 17 years cooking, well, actually almost 20 years in the culinary industry. And, you know, people say, oh, did you go to chef school or whatever? And I was like, people say that as alcoholics, we, normal people get in a rut and they try to get out of it. We fall in a rut and then we buy furniture, you know? And that's kind of what my culinary history was like, people say, did you go to culinary school? You really like cooking? And I said, no, I just knew it was better than dishwashing. So that's what I did. And my recovery job was almost 17 more years in cooking at one particular hotel on the West Side. But at Rutgers, I got such dependence on alcohol that I was shaky, sweaty, got kicked out of there, needed to drink. By the second time I got kicked out of school, the job I took, I worked, went down the Jersey Shore again, and the job I took was as a farm laborer in the cranberry bogs down in South Jersey. It was me, 5 Puerto Rican guys who were my buddies, they were my friends, and the town misfit. His father was the town drunk, and down the Jersey Shore, like, things really clear out come October or something like that. So the tumbleweeds start blowing down, and you know, it was really the end of the road. I invited all the Puerto Ricans to come live in my parents' house and collected a little rent from them. The town drunk son, I made him my trusty houseboy. It was very grandiose. So I said, you could be my houseboy there and stuff like that. I was drinking very, very, very heavily. Then the cranberry box season ended. I had nowhere else to go. I was collecting unemployment down the Jersey Shore. I just didn't have any sense of anything. This is it's like a really redneck type place. Actually, South Jersey is below the Mason-Dixie line. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I would go to the town pub like on a weekend, and I just had to be individualistic. Also, the two lesbians on Long Beach Island were people who were like living at my house too, and the 5 Puerto Ricans and everything. And I would go to the town pub on a weekend, and I'd with a kimono, little eye makeup, and chopsticks in my bun on top of my hair, and dance with the oldest woman in the place, and people wanted to kill me and stuff. But I wasn't, you know, I just had to. I was marching to the beat of my own drummer, and that drummer was alcohol, pretty much, you know. But I was trying to be something. I thought that if I walked into a bar with eye makeup and a bottle of Jack Daniels already, that they would think Keith Richards is here, you know. And, you know, that kind of portrayal or what it was good enough for me, you know, even though I had to wake up, you know. And I learned the horrors of having a shot in front of you and not wanting to show anybody that your hands are shaking so much that you don't know. I learned the horror of walking into a bank where it's air conditioned and sweating like crazy and not wanting to sign a check in front of anybody. Eventually, I had enough accidents because I kept falling, and I always fell on the left side of my face for some reason. I would get road rash. I would get it right here, and I have scars. I have lost a tooth in New York Ave in Atlantic City. You know, all kinds of things. So I have scars and stuff. But the main thing I want to say is that You know, I got accustomed to this kind of thing. I would get road rash here, and I knew what to do about it. I would put peroxide for a couple of days, and then after a few days it gets dry, you can pick out the tar, and then you start putting vitamin E, and you're, you know, good to go again. And this was very, very embarrassing for me. You know, pride is one of my major characteristics, and that's, I think, how my higher power got me into AA for the first time. I got sick and tired of people saying, "What happened to your face?" You know, and me trying to make, I wasn't much of a fighter, but, you know, saying, "Oh, you should see the other guy," that kind of thing. But, you know, it was because I was falling down, because I didn't know how much alcohol I could handle. And actually, that's how I got to AA for the first time. I got sick and tired of people saying, "What happened to your face?" I was back home living with my parents, and my first contact with AA was a woman named Liz. My mother sent me to. My mother knew her from religious work up in my neighborhood, food pantry kind of thing. And I had already been sent to guidance counselors and family counseling and, you know, a number of other things. This time I talked to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Liz told me her story. And it was amazing because the first person, I've been hearing for a long time about your drinking. People telling me about my drinking. Liz didn't talk to me about my drinking. She talked to me about her drinking and didn't make any demands of me. And she told me some embarrassing things about a woman drinking in the 40s and 50s and things that I wouldn't think she would normally tell a young man. And, you know, so that had some kind of effect on me. I drank. The next time I woke up in hospitals, that's part of my story. I ended up waking up in Roosevelt Hospital, and the story this time was I realized I had my I was on a gurney. I had my wallet, my shoes were there, so there was a nurse handing me peroxide yet again, and I saw that I had my wallet, my shoes, so I slipped into the bathroom with peroxide, put my shoes on, and grabbed my wallet, and I went out the door. I made a phone call. And I said, "Mom, I'm at 59th Street and 9th. And she says, "Sounds like you're at Roosevelt." I said, "Will you pay for a cab if I come home?" And yeah. She sent me to a man that she knew from church who was in AA. I talked to him on the phone. This was my second meeting for a person in AA. And I started saying, "I'll meet you later at this diner." I said, "I'm about this tall." He said, "He's about this." And then when I got home from meeting with him, it was wonderful. I talked to a guy named John O'D. It's really nice to see him around. I also see the person who drove me to my first AA meeting around. This was before I got sober, but I started going to meetings once John talked to me. But I went to the diner with him actually, when I got off the phone with him and saying I was this tall and everything, my mother said, "Why don't you just say that you're the guy with blood caked on your face?" You know? And so that's how I met John O'D. And I went to my first AA meeting up in the Bronx, with still scabs and stuff like that. I didn't hear that you can't be high and sober at the same time. I was doing a little changing seats on the Titanic kind of thing. I stayed dry for 18 months. I was embarrassed to say, I knew I wasn't doing it like you guys, but my mantra at that time was, "You don't understand. You don't understand. You know, you don't possibly understand what it's like to be in my head." You know, I knew I had drinking, I drank like you guys, but I didn't think you understood what it was like to be the pain that I experienced. Because actually, in these 18 months that I didn't drink but wasn't in AA, that was the most pain. The loneliness and the pain of that was something I hope to never experience again. 18 months, I picked up a drink going to visit somebody in South America. I had a job for 18 months, benefits, and through not drinking, I got my first vacation. Went to visit a friend who was going to school in Rio de Janeiro. Somebody mentioned to me, "Hey, Ed, you're going to go to Rio. Are you going to drink there?" That one little suggestion just planted the seed. And sure enough, on the plane, I picked up, after 18 months, I picked up my first drink. And I was scared because I'd been around AA enough to know, like, the first drink. I heard you guys say that enough. And I didn't know. I thought my guts might explode or alarms would go off and everybody would turn around in the plane and say, "He just had the first drink." But nothing happened. Or so I thought nothing happened. But when I met my friend at the airport, I looked into his eyes, and I had anything that I wanted to know about him and his life down here went out the window. I couldn't say, how's your girlfriend? What's this Brazilian woman you're living like? What's your life down here? I could look in his eyes, and all I could think was, do you have alcohol in your house? And if you don't, can we get some on the way there? You know, so that's what the first drink did to me on that plane. I came back here. The Mets won the World Series. Another good reason. You know, being a lifelong Mets fan is kind of rough. But that was 1986. Soon after that, I didn't know whether I would drink or not on any particular day there. And it wasn't glorious, glamorous drinking either. It was Old Men's and McCann's and stuff like that. I wound up at Roswell Hospital again, I think, and I actually made it to the sixth floor detox after that. In there, a man challenged me with the question, can an alcoholic love himself? And I was very smart, and but I couldn't answer that question. Actually, I went up to this detox really just because I was in a lot of pain, but I couldn't conceive of going to work yet another day, or I just couldn't see living on the outside another day. So I went to the rehab. I had red silk pajamas, grandiose. I had a library of books, Jean Genet, Steve's Journal, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Coney Island of the Mind. I thought I'd need these things. Mud mask, blue mud mask for my face, the red pajamas. And that ended kind of quickly because this man challenged me and he said, can an alcoholic love himself? And that question floored me. He said, look where you are. There's bars on the window. Your best thinking got you here. And I started to think. I looked up at the 12 steps when everybody left this little meeting in the detox. I looked at the 12 steps, and I felt deflation at depth. It was a horrible moment for me because I'd heard that an alcoholic's primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic, and it was far too small for me. I was so deflated. It was the most painful moment of my life. And then I started to make movements to try to see what I could do about it. In fact, my answer to the question, can an alcoholic love himself, was, I'm going to try. And then I came to AAA, and for some reason, I started doing everything I didn't before. At that time, we had changed for phones and stuff like that. I guess now you just got to make sure your phone's charged. But I joined a group. I have a wonderful recovery story. I haven't gotten that into it. I've had been at AA meetings all over the world. But I did everything you told me this time, whether I wanted to or not. And partially because, you know, I sort of wanted to be unique enough. Like if I was, even if I was more uniquely screwed up than you, I was okay with that. So I would did AA fully. So maybe one day I could say I did everything you said and I'm more screwed up than you. Didn't work for me, but it got me. They said if you want to find out what the program is, to look in a big book and read. It's unequivocal. Look at everywhere it says had to, have to, never, must. And the comforting thing about that is it never says you have to, you had to. It says we had to, we have to, we found we could never. And this kind of stuff has been guiding me with the help of a sponsor. I would like to stay sober for another 24 hours, and I think you've helped me very much tonight. Thank you.